Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Today's perspective on legal frolic.
I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
How's everything going over there?
Well, not too bad.
Yeah.
Back on track.
So we
don't have to be late getting our podcast up. We're recording on our usual Wednesday that we usually record, so we have it ready for Monday morning.
There's only a couple of differences. You've been experiencing some technical difficulty with your computer.
Yes, yes.
The updates, it was on the auto update, and it was giving you fits.
Yeah, that in the middle of that last one, I almost panicked. Here we were a day late, and I go to edit it Tuesday morning, and it did that drunk Donald Trump thing that it did on us a couple times before, where even after I sped it up, it still made us sound like this.
But in your infinite wisdom, you were able to figure out how to fix it.
Yeah, I went about it. I used the same fix that I did before, but I tried it a little bit differently, and I used bigger numbers. I think bigger numbers are good. Yeah, I was afraid to increase it too much because I was afraid we'd sound like Alvin and the Chipmunks. So I'd just been trying to move it along. But I think when you move it the first time, it kind of like sets it for there. You can only move it in small increments, and I never could quite get it up. So I went with a big chunk this time, and it almost had it perfect on the first try, so I went up two more on the next one. So it was like I multiplied it by five and instead of percentages.
Speaking of Alvin, Simon, Theodore, the Chipmunks, I used to have an album called Chipmunk Punk. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I used to love that album.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Call me, call me anytime, call me.
And I taught Charlie the traditional Chipmunks. The Witch Doctor song?
Oh, yeah.
Ooh-ee-ooh-ah-ah-ting-tang-walla-walla-bing-bang.
I think I had that record, too.
Ooh-ah-ah-ting-tang-walla-walla-bing-bang.
I had that on a 45.
Yeah.
That'll date myself.
That was that song, I think, actually made the top 40 in its day, like probably in the 60s or something like
that. It's definitely in the top five songs about witch doctors.
Yeah, it's got to be right up there, huh?
And the other difference is, so we're recording on my computer now. Look, this is we used to always record on my computer, but we haven't done that in a while.
Yeah, we were having trouble with yours, so I got a new one, and now mine's old, and it's out of date. And anyway, I started doing updates, and it's still running updates an hour later when we were set to record, so we had to go try it on yours so that we didn't have to abandon recording on time.
And then the final difference is that I have a delicious bowl of hot potato soup in front of me.
I know, and I told Mary made homemade potato soup. She said, I'm going to offer Michael a bowl for him to eat while you're podcasting. Well, I said, don't do that.
It's my mom's old recipe, so there's a little bit of nostalgia there.
Yeah, well, give it to him to go home, but don't give it to him before the podcast. He's going to be sitting there munching on it, and he'll be muttering through his mush.
So if you hear anything that sounds like somebody eating some potato soup with some oyster crackers.
That's you.
It could be me.
Yeah, it will be you. It's not me.
It could be.
I don't eat soup. Soup doesn't have enough substance for me. I got to have something I can sink my teeth into.
This potato soup has substance, I got to tell you. It is a thick, thick soup.
There's nothing to chew there. I need something to chew.
Well, how about you chew on this topic we picked out?
Only thing I don't chew is beer. Even that, I drink thick ones of those.
I asked you, when we were talking about this episode, that we could do alternative dispute resolutions. We've talked about it, I think, a little bit, maybe, but never actually in depth.
Right.
And I said, like mediation, arbitration, things like that. And so what do you think mediation is? Have you done any research on this yet?
No, not really. What I researched didn't really have anything to do with the topic.
So let's just take
Well, I mean, it did, but not exactly.
Let's just take a pre-quiz.
Okay.
What do you think mediation is?
Mediation is, instead of going to trial, instead of going before a jury or a judge, you go to somebody that is supposed to be impartial, and you accept ahead of time that whatever they rule, you'll go along with. And then you each present your side of the case, and that person decides what it should be.
Well, that is actually not mediation. I'll give you a hint.
There you go.
It is one part of alternative dispute resolution.
Yeah.
So I'll let you figure out which one you think it is once we hit on it.
Well, all right.
So.
Well, but see, here's the problem for me. Arbitration, mediation, that all means the same thing in my mind.
Right.
I don't know the difference.
Well, they are different.
I'm fairly ignorant.
Your words. So alternative dispute resolution can be described into four different categories. There could be more categories, but basically there's four. There's negotiation, mediation, collaborative law, and arbitration.
Okay.
So negotiation, and online, technically they call this ADR because it's a resolution that is alternative to going to court and settling it. You know, you're not going and having a judge or a jury make a decision, so you are negotiating. But negotiation takes place almost daily in the legal profession. So I don't really think of this as ADR when I think of ADR, although I guess it kind of is because...
Wasn't there a lot of times, it seems like I've heard where a judge will say, look, you all go back to the table and negotiate and see what you can come up with and then come back in here and tell me about it.
Well, that usually doesn't happen.
Really?
No.
I've seen that somewhere.
On TV?
Well, probably, yeah. Yeah.
That usually doesn't happen because by the time you get to trial in front of a judge and getting ready to have a trial, usually you've already been ordered to some sort of alternative dispute resolution by the judge. Mm-hmm. So, but negotiation usually even takes place at the outset before there's even a lawsuit filed, because a lot of times there's some sort of wrong that one party feels needs to be addressed by somebody else. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of times they'll do is they'll have an attorney send over a demand letter to somebody and say, hey,
I demand money.
Yeah. You breach this contract. I demand you pay me $25,000. Then the other person comes back and says, no, I'll give you $100. So, you know, there you are. There's negotiation as ADR. You're negotiating things back and forth.
Man, you got a big gap to fill there.
You do. And that's usually how these cases start out. You think, oh, this case is never going to settle. But a lot of times they do. So what happens with negotiation is it goes back and forth until the parties either reach a point that one of them decides to go ahead and file a lawsuit. And even after you file a lawsuit, negotiations can continue as well. But you know, sometimes cases settle before a lawsuit's even filed. I mean, that can happen too.
Well, that's a good thing, huh?
Yeah. And
you save money on that.
Sometimes, also I've noticed too in the legal profession, clients, they don't actually realize the gravity of the situation until they've paid some attorney's fees.
Mm-hmm.
So once they start paying their attorney's fees, some money to get ready for trial, all of a sudden, sometimes settling a case seems like a better idea.
Just like when you're going to court on principle.
Yeah.
When you find out how much your principles cost, sometimes you don't have principles.
Right. And the case can also backfire too if you have fees that are too high, because mm-hmm. at that point, to use like a poker term, you're pot committed. You basically can't back out of it at that point. You've got too much invested in it. You have to win.
And even if you do, you may not recover your costs.
That's true.
Depending on how you go about it.
That's true.
I mean, like, what if it's like small claims court or something like that?
I've had a couple cases where I've had friends that I've taken a case and said, oh, you know what? I'll file it for no charge and see mm-hmm. what I can do.
And you always regret it.
Always, because the problem is the person doesn't have any kind of skin in the game. So basically they're just saying, no, we'll just take it to court on principle. And I'm like, well, okay. But, you know, I'm doing this for free.
It's not free anymore.
Yeah.
My free ended at the filing.
Yeah.
That was it. Now,
so a lot of times I've learned.
Let me tell you how much I charge an hour.
I've learned over the course of dealing that, you know, if I am going to help a friend out by doing something like that, that I have to set a very, draw a line quickly and say, here's what I'll do. If it goes more than that, we're going to have to talk about this because I can't do this for free.
Right.
Because it would kill me.
Well, especially now that you're not an independent lawyer.
Yeah.
You work for somebody. You can't just go around and give away your time pro bonus.
That's true. But I can't really do that regardless when I had my own practice either. And in some situations, it actually might even be more detrimental because, you know, I'm the sole one responsible for keeping the lights on in my own practice.
Right. But, I mean, you had that freedom to make that choice.
Yeah.
When you work in a corporate environment, you can't just go around and decide who you're going to charge and who you're not. I think they would frown upon that.
They would probably frown upon if I gave away my services all willy-nilly.
Yeah.
But if I had, you know, a close friend that I needed to do something for and didn't charge them, nobody would say anything about it. It would be fine.
Your main boss would probably say, wow, we're going to have to do something about that boy. He's just going out there lawyering willy-nilly.
But I did use a poker term when I said pot committed.
Right.
And I've noticed there's actually quite a few similarities between poker and being a lawyer. So I believe that I've made a life from reading people's faces.
You got to know when to hold them and when to fold them.
I knew you'd pick up on my gambler reference. But yeah, it's the same thing with negotiations. You got to know basically what you want to counter with and what you want to go with is when you're doing negotiations.
Don't count your money at the table.
Yeah, no, not at all. And it also helps when you're picking a jury because you're trying to read people's faces, like Kenny Rogers said, trying to see if somebody's going to be favorable for you in the jury. So, you know, I think of myself as a bit of a high-stakes poker player in the courtroom.
Okay. I've never seen you in action, so I'll just have to take your word for
it. Sometimes I have to run out because of a royal flush.
Oh. You said you know where all the best bathrooms are.
I do. Now, mediation.
But what you really have to have when you're going into court is a pair.
You do.
Otherwise, the other one will run you off.
The bigger the pair, the better.
That's right. You need a big pair. Then now, you're aces.
The second kind of alternative dispute resolution, and this, when I think of alternative dispute resolution, I mean, this is basically what I think of as ADR. This is the, I would say, majority of what takes place, and that's mediation. And I would say probably most attorneys, when they think of ADR, they're thinking of mediation as well, because it's used the most. And what mediation is not somebody making a decision, like you had said. It's something different. It's defined as a dynamic, structured, interactive process where a neutral third party assists disputing parties in resolving conflict through the use of specialized communication and negotiation techniques. So basically,
that means absolutely nothing to me.
Well,
that was just words that were randomly spewed out of your mouth like potato soup.
Well, people have to actually participate in mediation.
Yeah.
A lot of times the court will order them to go to mediation before you go to trial. In almost every pretrial order, there's a mandatory mediation date set where the court wants to put the parties in the same room with somebody and see if they can resolve this so they don't waste the court's time trying to try it and all that. Because if it can be settled, it should be settled. A lot of times with mediation, you go into a room and you're in there with the other party and there's a mediator. Now, the mediator's job is not to make a decision as to who wins and who loses. The mediator's job is to help communicate between the parties and try to facilitate an agreement between the parties. So, for example, to go back to our prior example of somebody in a contract dispute saying $25,000, the other person saying $100,000, you know, they'll try to talk to the other side and say, well, I mean, your contract, your damages are really only how much? And so, well, do you think $25,000 is a little high? Would you be willing to come off that? And then they might go to the other side and talk to them and say, well,
You feel you have a least bit of responsibility in this?
$100. If you have to go to trial, I mean, your attorney's fees alone are going to be $8,000 or $9,000 in this. I mean, is it worth you to settle it for, you know, nuisance value just for that? Can we move up a little bit on that?
And I got a coupon here for 10% off you can use.
So basically, that's kind of what the mediator does, is they try to talk to the parties and keep them moving and try to reach some sort of
settlement. So they reach their own agreement in a way? I mean, the two different parties, they kind of like eventually say, I can live with that. Yeah, I can live with that. Let's shake on it.
Yeah, the two parties, they actually have to come to the agreement. It's nothing the mediator does or decides. So a lot of mediators will tell you this is a chance for you to take control of your own case and make a decision about what you want. That if you go to a trial in front of a jury, you don't get to make a decision. A judge or a jury is making a decision. You don't get to have any say in it at that point. This is your lone chance to try to make a decision, take the case into your own hands, and settle it yourself. So, you know, that's
can you do that with any kind of case? I mean, I guess it's got to be a civil case, not a criminal case.
There is some kind of mediation in criminal cases. It's not very prevalent, and it's only usually used for small, like, property crimes. A lot of times, between neighbors and neighborhood disputes and things like that, because at the end of the day, criminal cases between neighbors doesn't really help anybody. It's just going to lead to more problems. So if you can get the people together talking and come to some sort of agreement about something, then that can be a good way to diffuse a neighborhood situation.
Would be civil though, wouldn't it?
No, it would be criminal.
Really?
Yeah. But it's not very widely used.
Like trying to get him for trespassing or something?
Yeah,
he walked into my yard and I told him, don't come in here. And
Yeah.
Something like that. He stepped on my prize daisy.
Yeah, or, yeah, just different things like that. I mean, it's not very widely used, but it can be. So, as I said, the mediator is not somebody who makes a decision about the case. They're simply there to try to facilitate some sort of agreement. And the funny thing is that each mediator has their own spiel they usually use at the beginning. Like I said, it almost always involves something about how mediation is a process. You have to really buy into it, and the mediator believes in it, and that they want you to believe in it, too. It's a very, you know, kind of positive type situation the mediator wants to project, not mm-hmm. a negative type thing like a courtroom sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the mediator almost always says a chance for you to take control of your case. If you don't settle it now, somebody else is going to decide the outcome. There was one mediator I liked a lot, and he always talked that he said a good mediation is like making a pie. You have to have all the ingredients. The parties were like the filling, the mediator was like the crust, and you had to bake it at a certain temperature, or basically a certain amount of time with negotiations to get the pie just right. So, always, you know, each mediator has, like I said, their own kind of like thing, and they always say the same things over and over again. It's just like, but if you've had a mediator several times, when the mediator's sitting there talking, you're just kind of drawing daisies on your paper because you're like, oh my goodness, I don't want to hear it again.
What mediator did you have? The crusty one?
Some people say that if everyone leaves the mediation unhappy, that the mediator did a good job.
Really?
Yeah.
I would think it'd be just the opposite.
No, because basically if everyone comes to an agreement on something, but nobody's really super happy about it,
mm-hmm.
then they probably
That means they compromised.
They probably compromised, and they probably didn't meet in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sometimes called the sign of a good mediation.
Well, I guess I can understand that.
The interesting thing is, having attended ADR or mediation in different states, is the way it's conducted kind of differently.
Hmm.
And this is just kind of culturally. Now, down in Florida, you would go into a room. The mediator would usually sit at the head of the table. The parties sit on opposite sides.
Mm-hmm.
And the mediator gives their opening spiel, and they talk about it. And then a lot of times, they would turn to the plaintiff and say, all right, you brought this case. Why don't you tell me what this case is about? And then basically, you would make an opening statement, kind of similar to what you would do in court, but very, very informal and very brief. You're not standing up. You're just sitting at a table. And then after you finish, the mediator would say something like, well, thank you very much, Mr. Meadows, for that. Now I'll hear from Mr. So-and-so for the defendant. What's your point of view about this case? And basically they would make their statement about it. And then he says, okay. And so do we have any, have there been any offers about this? And they might ask it. And then sometimes they would go back and forth a little bit at the table. But usually what would happen is they would do what they call breakout sessions or caucuses. And so what would happen is the mediator would say, okay, well, I'm going to go into the other room with the defendant. I'm going to talk to them for a few minutes. And they would just decide which party they wanted to talk to first. And they usually say something like, don't read into anything about how long I spend with the other party. I'm just going to talk to them. And as soon as I get done talking to them, I'm going to come back and talk to you. And then what will happen is the mediator will kind of go back and forth and convey offers and convey different arguments and things like that back and forth between the parties.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of how it was conducted in Florida as far as the opening of it. In West Virginia, it's different, which is kind of, it's just very different. You go into the room.
They're all armed.
The last mediation I attended, the mediator stood up, and I think I did actually see a sidearm on him. I'm not even joking. It wasn't in a courthouse, but whatever.
I would if I was a mediator with some of these yahoos we got around here.
Yeah, you never know. But so we go sit at the table just like you would in Florida, and the mediator gives their opening spiel, you know, whether it's about a pie or something. And then the mediator doesn't even ask for opening statements. The mediator just says, okay, we're going to go ahead and break out our caucus right now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually one I attended where we didn't even have an opening session together. You just said, I'm going to stick you in there. We're going to get to business. So in West Virginia, they don't view it as much as as the parties having any kind of argument or influence over the other party. Because in Florida, I mean, sometimes you might actually prepare like an elaborate opening statement. If you had a really big case, you might prepare a PowerPoint with different demonstrations of things that you're going to show at trial to show the other side, hey, I'm ready to go to trial on this, and here's the evidence I'm going to put up. You need to settle today. But they don't take that approach here. And here they basically just do breakout sessions and try to negotiate it.
Hmm.
So, and a lot of times the way it'll work is the mediator will talk to one side, and they'll say similar things, like I said, like, well, you know, what do you think your actual damages are in this case? And if you're a little too high, they say, okay, well, you know, why are you asking this much? Can you come down a little bit? And they'll go back and forth with different offers. And then they'll get to a point where they'll either reach a settlement, or sometimes people will say, well, I'll go to $10,000. That's my final offer. It's take it or leave it. You either take it or I'm walking out of here. And a lot of times when people say that to me, I just go ahead and make another counteroffer and say, okay, well, how about this? Because, you know, I mean, basically, what are you going to lose by that? And a lot of times, they'll actually come back and make another counteroffer. You can kind of call their bluff. Mm-hmm. They're not really saying take it or leave it. So, again, it's kind of like poker. You know, you have to kind of be able to read what you think the other side is actually doing. So, but if, you know, they do actually have, they run out of money to give to one side, or you're not going to come down anymore, or you don't have any money to give or whatever, then at that point, the mediator can call what's called an impasse. And if there's an impasse, then the mediator writes it up and says, hey, we tried to mediate it. The parties are too far apart. We're at an impasse. And then at that point, you would have a green light to go back to court and say, we tried to mediate it. We're ready to go to trial. So, and that's kind of how mediation works. Now, if you do have an impasse, there are some different techniques which are kind of employed sometimes to try to break the deadlock.
Hmm.
One of them, which I just like the name of, I've never actually used it, but I just really like the name of it and the theory of it, is called the silver bullet.
The silver bullet.
Yeah. So the silver bullet is used to describe a quick, effective solution to a difficult problem. It's, you know, of course, it's derived from the fact that, you know, it kills vampires and all those different things, or werewolves and that kind of stuff. And so basically, when a mediator wants to use a silver bullet, the mediator tells both sides that they're close to an impasse, but then asks the parties if they're willing to reveal their actual bottom line to the mediator. And so this bottom line is never actually disclosed to the other side. So if the parties agree, they'll typically write the number down and give it to the mediator. If the two numbers overlap, then basically a settlement has been reached.
Hmm.
And a lot of times, so like say if one person's bottom line is 10 and the other person's bottom line is 20, then the settlement would be 15. They mm-hmm. would meet kind of in the middle.
Right.
But if they don't overlap, then it's just an impasse. Hmm. But it's kind of a way to kind of break a deadlock and use the final thing to see, like, hey, maybe let's try to get this done for something. And sometimes, even after you do that, the mediator might say, look, now, I can't tell you what the other side's bottom line was. You know what yours is, but you all are close. I think we should keep mediating. And so that's just another technique a mediator might use to keep the parties kind of going back and forth. Like, you know, I know that you're bottom line, but you're pretty close. I mean, you know, what's another couple $1,000 here and there? So it's just kind of one of those things that you want to use as a tool.
Hmm.
Another issue, or another way you can kind of try to break an impasse, is a technique called bracketing. And basically what this is that where the mediator is trying to get the parties to kind of make a bigger jump to get into what he considers, or she considers, a more realistic zone where settlement might actually occur, or be possible.
Yeah.
And basically you're not negotiating numbers at that point. You're negotiating the ranges. So basically what happens is one party proposes that they will move to a certain position if the other party will reciprocate by moving to a different position that brings the parties closer together.
Mm-hmm.
So basically say the plaintiff's opening demand was $500,000 and the defendant responded with an offer of $50,000. The negotiations like don't really go anywhere. And then the plaintiff is at $480,000 and the defendant's at like $55,000. So they're still, you know,
way apart,
way apart.
Yeah.
So basically at that point, the defendant might say, hey, I'll tell you what, I'll move to 100 if the plaintiff will move to 250. So they'll make a big jump if they'll make a big jump.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a way of kind of getting them closer together. And that's called bracketing.
Okay.
So it's just another technique that sometimes is used. Before you go to mediation, you really do have to have an idea as to what you think the case is worth. You have to know basically what you think it is, because that's how you...
As the mediator or as the one of the... The plaintiff or defendant?
As the plaintiff or defendant.
Okay.
If you go in there and you haven't really evaluated your case and you're not taking it seriously and you're not looking at it, I mean, you're not going to have a resolution to it. You're not going to have a good mediation. You have to actually put in work before you go to mediation.
You probably have to take the emotion out of it.
Absolutely.
Because if you're there, I'm going to make this son of a bitch pay. Well, I want $500,000.
And
the guy damaged your $3,000 valued car or something like that, you know?
Yeah, and a lot of times, you know, your client... They're pretty upset too. I mean, you might make what you think is a reasonable offer, and they might mm-hmm. come back with like $1,000, and the client's like, "Well, that's an insult. I'm not even going to sit here and listen to that." And like, no, that's just the way this game's played. you know, they're going to come back with that. And I always
don't take it personal.
No, the mediator says that too. That's another thing I forgot to mention. The mediator always says that in their opening too. You know,
don't take it personal.
Don't take it personal. It's just the way it's going to be.
We're just all just good people here. We're all good folks, and we're going to come to a conclusion.
Now, there can be other things, too, that can be part of the settlement other than just money. There can be some sort of, basically, you know, some people might want a letter of apology. Sometimes that's really important to people, and that might be part of the negotiation settlement, too. Like, well, I'll take this much if you do a letter of apology, or if it's like an employment discrimination case, something like that. Like, well, I'll take this much if you give me a good letter of recommendation. You know, so they're like, well, okay, that seems reasonable. So, you know, there's different ways to negotiate, and good mediators are always thinking of different ways to kind of sweeten the deal without necessarily using just money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, money is what it ultimately comes down to, is what's going to win the day. But there are other things that can kind of sugarcoat it. So if people are farther apart, that they might be willing to settle based on some other kind of intangible type thing that relates to the case or the people. So mediation is a very interesting process, and I know a good deal about it because I'm actually a board-certified circuit civil mediator.
Well, what do you know about that?
Yeah, there you go.
What's your recipe? Are you the pie guy?
No, I'm not the pie guy.
Oh.
No, my spiel is pretty vanilla standard when I just talk about how mediation is a good process. I do usually say it's a chance for them to take control of their case. And that, you know, it's a good process that I believe in, and we'll work together and see what we can do, you know, something along those lines. Now, if you do actually get an agreement, actually, if you don't get an agreement either, at the end of the mediation, a mediator has to make a mediator's report. And what they'll do is, if it's an impasse, they'll just write impasse, and they'll file it with the court case or give it to the parties to file with the court case. If it is a settlement, then what the mediator will do is the mediator will write up the agreement that is basically agreed to by the parties. Now, this is going to be a bare bones type agreement. It's not going to have everything in it, because usually there's going to be releases and hold harmless agreements and confidentiality agreements and all those type things that need to get kind of hammered out. And you can't do that all at mediation.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it takes too long to prepare those documents and nobody has them.
So you have to get them all drawn up after the mediation and then send them to everybody or have them come in and sign them or whatever.
Exactly. So basically at the mediator's report, the mediator just says, like, we'll settle the case for this amount of money, and the plaintiff agrees to file sign a release and a confidentiality agreement. We in turn will write a check for this amount. So that is just basically along those type things. Then what'll happen is a couple of days later, the attorney will send over a confidentiality agreement, and then also a settlement agreement and things like that, a release, and then they'll negotiate that out. Now, sometimes when people are really feeling litigious, they'll start arguing about the different things that are in the settlement agreements. So, you know, it is a little bit uncommon to go back to court, but you can go back to court and argue over those with people too, which, you know, is never fun. So, but the mediator's statement is basically just the bare bones kind of what the parties essentially agree to. It's up to the parties to get the hammer out the fine teeth.
Because most of the time, I'm assuming that people haven't been through that before.
No.
So you don't really know exactly how it works. Now, do you have to have a lawyer represent you when you go to a mediation?
You don't. It just depends. If you are represented by a lawyer, you would want to have that lawyer there with you.
Right.
But you don't have to. I mean, a lot of times, especially I know in Florida, in small claims court, they would have...
You don't have to have a lawyer in small claims court, do you?
No, you don't. Well, most people don't. They try to make it very easy for just the layperson to file their own lawsuit.
Yeah, because you don't want to win your $200 lawsuit and then pay a lawyer $5,000.
Right. And a lot of times what they'll do is they'll have mediators or lawyers that are there in court that day. The judge always liked it in Florida. If there were some lawyers that were in small claims court, they'd say, hey, while you're here, these two pro se litigants over here need to mediate this case. Can you go act as a mediator for them? And so,
really?
Yeah.
They just pull you out of the crowd?
Yeah. Well,
like
a
pickup basketball game. It's a pickup mediation, huh?
Kind of. And yeah, if you're a lawyer, say, okay, well, you know, because most lawyers have been to tons and tons of mediation.
Yeah, but what do you get out of that?
The goodwill of the judge, because the judge asks you to do it.
Oh, man.
And you're sitting there anyway, waiting for your case. So
I would keep my head down. I got my earphones in. I can't hear you.
I got a funny story about a judge drafting me. I don't know if I told you this one or not.
I don't think so.
It doesn't have anything to do with ADR, but I'll go ahead and tell it because it's really funny. So I was in Judge Farrell's courtroom probably about a year and a half ago, and I saw there was a someone who was appointed to a case, in a criminal case, and there was a public defender in there. And usually when there's appointed counsel, that means the public defender had a conflict. So they can't handle that defendant. And the appointed counsel had filed a motion to withdraw as counsel because they said that differences had arisen between the client and him, and he couldn't continue to represent him. And the client seemed a little batty. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to lie. I was a little like, ooh, this guy's a little out there. And about, I don't know, a minute into this, I'm looking around, I realize I'm the only attorney in here. If I'm sitting in here, Judge Farrell is going to appoint me to this case. I do not want to take this case. So, and of course, I was sitting on the front row because my case was going to be next. And so I kind of dug in my pocket, looked at my phone like I had a phone call, and then walked outside the courtroom, you know, thinking,
got out of that one.
And so I'm outside. I walk kind of down the hallway from it. I don't want to go too far because I'm the next case to be called.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just run away completely.
Right.
So I'm out there probably 2 or 3 minutes wandering around. I kind of walk back down to the close to where the doors to the courtroom open up. And I'm standing there for maybe another 10, 15 seconds. And all of a sudden, the bailiff opens the door. He said, "Hey, Mr. Meadows, judge needs you back in here." I thought, oh, great. So I walk in, and the first words out of the judge's mouth were, "Nice try, Mr. Meadows."
He knew what you were doing.
He knew exactly what I was doing.
He saw the panic look on your face when you looked around the room and summed up what was happening.
So sure enough, the judge appointed me to that case. And I was like, oh, great. So yeah, that was kind of a judge drafting you. Pick up lawyering. So, but mediation happens in pretty much every single civil case. It would be rare in this day and age to have a civil case that does not have a mediation at some point. So
I didn't know that was such a standard thing.
Oh, it is. I mean, it is huge. And a lot of times you can do what's called pre-suit mediation too. If you think there's a chance you might be able to resolve it before filing a lawsuit.
Yeah.
There's lots of different ways to handle mediation. It's a good process. I like it. So now the next kind of ADR is something that I've actually never done before. It's called collaborative law. And this is kind of bigger, I think, not so much inside the U.S., maybe outside the United States. And it's often used in divorce or family law. And it's essentially a legal process where couples who have decided to basically separate or in their marriage, they work with collaborative professionals, including different lawyers, like not different lawyers, but including a lawyer, financial consultants and things like that. And what they do is they meet with these people and they come to an agreement outside the court spectrum to get divorced, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So
they divide the assets and settle any kind of alimony or child support or anything like that?
Correct, without any kind of litigation.
Then when they go before the judge, they already have that, and all they have to do is kind of like grant it?
Yep, and then basically they'll sign a contract, basically some sort of agreement, and then that agreement will then get filed with the court, which will essentially ratify it based upon, you know, they'll probably say, did you have a chance to look at this agreement? Do you believe it's a fair and equitable distribution?
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever, blah, 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 blah. And it can be kind of a good idea, I think, in principle, if you have parties that are willing to do that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess that it runs the gamut from those that are, you know, parting ways and, you know, not mad at each other, all the way to those that want to kill the other one. So,
yeah.
And not everything in between. So, but there are probably, at least in the 50% of them that can do that and come to their own equitable agreement would probably rather do it themselves than let the government decide.
Absolutely. And the weird thing about this is there's only going to be usually like one lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lawyer for each person. There's
right.
one lawyer, and
that's a way to save money.
And they don't represent either party. They're just
right.
there to say, hey, you know, this is what I think and mm-hmm. whatever, and try to basically create a win-win situation outside the court system for these people. Now, the interesting thing is there's usually one caveat to it. That if one of the parties threatens to file any kind of court action or lawsuit, well, and like basically saying, well, I don't agree with that, I'm just going to go ahead and file a lawsuit. Then at that point, immediately the collaborative session is off, and your only recourse is to file a lawsuit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you can't say, well, I was just bluffing or
yeah,
something.
Yeah. You can't use that as a bargaining chip. If it's going to be collaborative, it's going to be truly hand-in-hand collaborative. So, which I think that's a good idea.
Sure.
So,
do they warn them that ahead of time, I guess?
I would think so. Like I said, I've never been a part of that. I've never done that before. I've been part of divorces where one party has hired me, and I've sent basically paperwork to the other side that they've already agreed to and just kind of walked it through. But I make it very clear that I only represent one person, because to me, I think it's unethical to represent two people, especially in a court setting. Now, I mean, if you have some sort of a out of court type thing and it's very clear that you're not representing either party, then I think you can probably do that. But, you know, in my role as a lawyer, I just feel much more comfortable only representing one party. I always tell people, like, I can't represent both of you. I only have one horse to ride. I've only got one butt, and I can only sit on one horse.
That's true. You got two cheeks, so.
I do have two cheeks.
You put one on each horse.
That would be uncomfortable.
Well, it could be, depending if they were real skinny horses, they sat up close. But so, I bet you if that mediator pie judge guy was the one in there, then he would warn them all ahead of time, say, look, now, once we agree to start baking this pie, we're all going to be in agreement on this pie.
That's right.
And if we start baking a cherry pie, don't raise your hand up and say, I want to make a blueberry pie, because then there ain't going to be no pie for anybody. You understand?
That's right. And once that pie comes out in the oven and we start eating it, don't run over here and tell me you want to put some ice cream on top, because we ain't got no ice cream.
That's right. You didn't ask for ice cream. Nobody mentioned ice cream. Don't raise your hand for ice cream.
And don't even think about putting a slice of cheese on that, you disgusting animal.
That's right. Cheese ruins a pie.
Some people like that, though.
I know. I don't know why. It was like that whole thing we went through with Charles at the restaurant that time when he was staying with us in Waycross.
What was that?
Well, waitress said, would you like any dessert? He said, do you have apple pie? And she said, we sure do. Would you like me to heat you up a piece? And he goes, well, yeah, I guess I can wait till it cools off. And she goes, well, we don't have to heat it up. And he goes, oh, okay, well, then don't. And she goes, do you want a scoop of ice cream on it? And he goes, okay, I'll just scrape it off. She said, well, you don't have to have ice cream on it. Oh, okay. Well, I don't want ice cream.
Oh, that's so funny. Charles and I were such different kids growing up.
I know.
Charles was very like kind of like that. And I was definitely not like that. I was a little more precocious.
That was the same night that he asked the waitress when he couldn't decide what he wanted. And he said, she said, well, we got this kind of chicken and we got fish. And he thought for a minute and he goes, what's the difference between chicken and fish? And she looked at him and looked at us and she said, one's chicken and one's fish. She didn't know how to answer. Hung her up.
And just so if you don't know, Charles is probably the smartest person I know.
Like he's the most intelligent.
He is a certified genius.
But there's just common sense things that just go right over his head.
Yeah. But he would laugh at that, too, though. He's a good sport about it. So there's only one more type of ADR that I mentioned in the list.
Yeah.
And it's called arbitration.
Okay.
Have you heard anything that sounds like what you thought mediation was?
Well, arbitration.
You're right. What you described to me was actually arbitration.
Okay.
So what do you think arbitration is?
Well, I think it's when two groups agree to meet before a judge type person that will decide how it'll go, and whatever that judge decides, both parties agree ahead of time that they will accept it.
That's right. That's kind of what it is. Binding arbitration. That's very similar to kind of the court process, and it's usually conducted in front of one or possibly three arbitrators.
Never two?
Never two. You don't want the deadlock. I mean, come on. And it's essentially like a little mini trial. There's rules of evidence, things like that. But arbitration usually goes to court, not court, but goes to a hearing or something like that much faster. And a lot of times at a lower cost, too. And the arbitrator is the person who makes the final decision to the parties. And usually you can appeal that, but appeals from an arbitrator or binding arbitration are usually not very successful. So
a lot of times that's written into contracts, isn't it? Where like labor unions and stuff like that agree to go to arbitration as opposed to going to court on certain things and stuff like that.
It absolutely is. And many contracts actually have binding arbitration clauses in them, which essentially divests the court of any kind of jurisdiction to hear a matter and allows the party to force binding arbitration. Now, if For example, if you have a contract dispute that has a binding arbitration clause in it, and you file a lawsuit, and I don't want to have arbitration, I could just file an answer and we'll just proceed to court. But alternatively, if I don't necessarily want to go to court, then I can file some sort of motion for asking the court to compel arbitration because it's required in the contract. So that's the way that works.
So it is written, so it shall be.
That's right. The arbitration process, it was super in vogue for the construction industry and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of became a little bit less popular because people were kind of seeing that the arbitration costs were not actually any less than basically the court costs.
Mm-hmm.
And the decisions you were getting sometimes were really all over the board. And almost you were better off actually having a judge make a decision on it because you weren't saving any money by doing it.
Well, I think professional sports, that when they're having those player lockouts and things like that, when they go on strike, like the baseball strike and everything, I believe those were settled by an arbitrator.
They are, yeah. A lot of those different unions have that, like mm-hmm. Any kind of union usually has arbitration. And sometimes you'll see how, like, your credit card statements and things like that. Like if you have a problem with a credit card company, that what they'll do is they'll have some sort of binding arbitration clause in their thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that what'll happen is they'll have that in their cardholder agreement that there's binding arbitration.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll go ahead and try to sue you in small claims court to collect on something.
Mm-hmm.
And you could file a motion to compel our mandatory arbitration in South Dakota. So,
well, I would do that.
You might have to go to South Dakota, but you know.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Well, I'd want to have it here where I live.
Well, but a lot of times it'll say, by signing this cardholder agreement, you agree to binding arbitration in South Dakota.
Oh, okay. So they're trying to make it as uncomfortable for you as possible.
Absolutely.
Because nobody wants to go to South Dakota. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Okay.
But, you know, you can call their bluff and, again, playing poker and try to get the case moved out. So, but that's the different kinds of alternative dispute resolution. Actually, I took a class in law school called ADR, Alternative mm-hmm. Dispute Resolution,
mm-hmm.
and the difference being, there was also a class called Mediation. The interesting thing was they used the same book, but basically the mediation class just focused on mediation the entire time,
mm-hmm.
whereas the ADR class focused on mediation only about 75% of the class. So if that gives you an idea about how prevalent mediation is as an ADR standpoint.
So arbitration is more of a specialized thing, whereas mediation is used in a lot of different circumstances.
Exactly. Yeah, I would say mediation arbitration is probably 75-1. That's mm-hmm. how often attorneys probably do it.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it is way, way, way more prevalent. So, but you ever had any kind of a alternative dispute resolution?
No, not that I know of. If I was involved in it, I didn't know I was.
Have you ever eaten any pie?
I have eaten pie.
There you go.
I enjoy eating pie.
You're basically like a mediator.
Well, what I found when you said, did you do any research? Well, I did do research, but what I went after was the Judge Judy angle, because, you know,
well, hold on a second. You always go after the Judge Judy angle.
Well, I like Judge Judy. She's the best judge I know, but it turns out she's not actually a judge.
She's not.
No. It says she was a judge. She was a real live judge in New York City. She was appointed by Mayor Ed Koch. Remember him?
I do.
He appointed her to family court in 1982 and then made her Manhattan supervising family court judge in 1986.
He was in Ghostbusters.
Yeah. He was on several different things. He was kind of like a Rudy Giuliani before Rudy Giuliani.
Before Rudy Giuliani went
nuts.
Yeah.
But anyway, the TV court shows like hers don't take place in real courtrooms, and they don't feature real trials, though they are usually real cases. What they do is that they use arbitration as a legal method for resolving the disputes outside of court. The disputing parties present their case to the neutral third-party arbitrator or arbitrators who hear the case, examine the evidence, and make a binding decision. Now, for them, what they do is this is part that I didn't know.
Okay.
The producers go out and search the small claims courts in all these different cities and look for cases they think will be good for it, and then send them a letter saying, hey, we'd like for you to come to our show and we're going to pay to fly you out. We're going to put you up in a hotel, and we'll feed your, we'll pay your meals, and then you come and be on the show.
Yeah.
And you sign this agreement, and you're agreeing that whatever Judge Judy decides, you accept that as the agreement. But here's the real catch of it. They don't have to pay anything.
Right, because if they have to end up having to owe money, then they'll pay it.
Yeah, the company, the production company, pays whoever loses.
Yeah, you didn't know that?
And no, and then you get you get an appearance fee as well for being on there. I mean, it's not much. It's like maybe anywhere from $150 to $500 or something like that. But that's the way they go around finding them. TV judges make their decision on a case and either decide for the plaintiff, in which the show's producers award them a judgment fee, or with the defendant, in which case the producers award both parties with an appearance fee. This system seems to skew things in favor of the defendants and gives them an incentive to take their case from court to TV. If they have a weak case, appearing on the show absolves them of any financial responsibility. They have a strong case, they stand to earn an appearance fee along with their victory.
And a free trip.
That's right.
And a chance to be on TV.
Yeah. If one party or the other doesn't like the arbitrator's decision, it can really only be successfully appealed if it addresses a matter outside the scope of the contract. In 2000, Judge Judy had one of her decisions overturned for that reason by the Family Court of Kings County in the case BM v. DL. The parties appeared in front of Scheinlin to solve a personal property dispute. This is weird. Scheinlin ruled on that dispute, but also made a decision on the party's child custody and visitation rights. One of the parties appealed in court, and the family court overturned the custody and visitation part of the decision because they weren't covered by the agreement to arbitrate.
That doesn't matter. She wouldn't have the jurisdiction to do that anyway.
I know. That's what I mean. I can't believe if she was a family court judge. So she knew probably a lot about it, but somehow she decided she was going to rule on visitation.
I wouldn't even appeal that. I would just use it as toilet paper.
I can't believe that. But so she did that. So that's only one of her decisions that has ever been overturned. But I think she got a little carried away.
It should be. Jeez.
But I found this other article said the hypocrisy of Judge Judy. It says, and I don't like this. I don't like him talking bad about Judge Judy. Judge Judy is known for her quick rulings, pithy sayings, and forceful personality. And it's hard to think of a judgment as quick, a saying as pithy, or a performance as forceful as the case she settled in only 26 seconds.
Whoa!
This was her quickest case she ever settled. Now see if you can figure out where this guy slipped up.
Okay.
The ladies testify, she says, "I had to replace all my IDs," said Jenny Paradisa, as she explained that the two men in the courtroom had stolen her purse. "I had gift cards in there, an earpiece, and a calculator." As she spoke, one of the defendants interrupted. "There was no earpiece in there, ma'am," he told Judge Judy.
Yeah.
The courtroom laughed. By calling Mrs. Paradisa a liar, the man had revealed that he'd stolen her purse. Judge Judy smiled, pointed at the defendants, and called them dumb and dumber. Judgment for the plaintiff in the amount of $500, Judge Judy concluded. Goodbye. The case is one of thousands that Judy Scheinlin has settled as the host of Judge Judy, a reality television show that first aired in 1996. The cases are minor but real, drawn from the country's small claims courts. The 20-year run of Judge Judy has been one of the most remarkable in television history. Has had the highest ratings of any daytime show for the last 5 years, and it consistently attracted more viewers than Oprah. Scheinlin makes $47 million a year and has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Wow. She makes more than most judges.
Yeah. Way more. Scheinlin has enjoyed her commercial success. She also says she uses her show to teach lessons. If I could define it in one word, she has said of her message, it's responsibility. People really want their fellow man to accept responsibility for themselves and their actions. She reiterates the theme of responsibility and accountability over and over in interviews. She lambasts a welfare state that tells people not to worry. If you can't take care of yourself, we'll take care of you. On her show, she gives a tongue-lashing to defendants who make excuses and reprimands victims who exercise poor judgment. Accountability is her thing, and like most of what you see on television, it's mostly an illusion, because as even Judy Scheinlin has acknowledged, after she admonishes guilty defendants and orders them to pay for what they've done, the producers write a check to pay for those damages and give everyone in the case an appearance fee. In other words, the producers help the defendants avoid actual accountability.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's one thing. Like, she's teaching a lesson, but she's not really teaching a lesson to them. She's teaching a lesson to anybody else that's watching.
That's right. She's trying to play it. But she was the same type of judge when she was a judge. That's the way she was in her court. And that's what brought her to the attention of people and asked her to try doing this TV show, because she was fiery like that. It said that Judge Shineland's early life reveals few hints that she would become the queen of daytime television. She grew up middle class in Brooklyn. Shineland has described her time in high school as an unremarkable tenure. Her mother as a meat and potatoes kind of gal, and the idea of being on television as a fantasy. She expected to be a working girl, so after graduating from American University in D.C., she enrolled in its law school. But Judith Shineland had the personality of Judge Judy all along. She loved to argue so much that her father believed she would become a politician. Shineland has also said that she picked up comedic timing from her father, who was a dentist who told jokes to reassure his patients. For that reason, when Shineland first watched The People's Court, the first courtroom television show, she believed she believed she could do it better than its sober, analytical judges.
Judge Wapner and Greg Llewellyn.
But she had to put off her law school for a while because she got married and she had to work and take care of the kids to help support the family. And so she had to go to law school later on in life. So that's why she got kind of a late start to her...
She's making up for lost time.
That's right. But he says she found her mission when Mayor Ed Koch appointed her as a judge, and it was an important $90,000 a year job that involved managing 9 judges and hundreds of attorneys when she became the head of the family court. Yet family court is distinctly unglamorous. Cases can be gruesome, but since they focus on minors, they exist at the bottom of the judicial hierarchy. Family courts receive fewer resources, and its judges and attorneys handle far too many cases. Burnout is common. Many fans of Judge Judy now wonder whether Shineland bullies, insults, and mocks people in her courtroom for the sake of TV ratings. But it's not an act. She has always bullied, insulted, and mocked the people in her courtroom. One of the more memorable exchanges was a phenomenon captured in her book that she wrote. She said she told a teenager that was in her court, "Don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining," she yells at a teenager who claims he began peddling drugs after a death in his family. Nobody goes out and sells crack because grandma died. Get a better story.
That sounds like one of my mom's sayings, but it wasn't her leg.
Yeah, it was her back.
Yeah.
But anyway, she became very well storied in the New York area. So people came and watched her in court, and that's when they offered her the job doing that. So she ended up getting in there and becoming extremely successful, a success that nobody could have figured. And so that led later to a big lawsuit because the production company evidently that produced the show didn't sign a very good contract. So when Judge Judy became famous, she had the leverage to say, "This is what I want, $47 million, or I'm not doing the show." So CBS, who at that time was doing the show, through that production company, they had to pay her that. Well, the production company's contract evidently said that they got a share of the profits, of the profits. Mm-hmm. So CBS has been claiming for the last however many years, there's been no profit because of the salary they have to pay Judge Judy, so the production company doesn't get any money.
Right.
So the production company is trying to take a standpoint, that's not reasonable. That's your all's fault for paying her that much.
Right.
But so far it hadn't standard. And her comment is, I'm the highest paid woman on TV, and that's why you all are coming after me. If I was a man, nobody would say anything.
Right.
But since I'm a woman, that's why you're after me. She said, I earned every bit of it, or they wouldn't be paying it to me.
Yeah. You have to be crazy to come after Judge Judy.
Yeah, she'll put you in your place real fast.
Bite your head off.
That's right. But she is my hero. I wish every case was decided by Judge Judy.
I'm glad that mine aren't. I like a less combative judge.
I like her. She's straight to the point.
I like, was it a...
No BS.
Less filling, tastes great. I'm more of a light judge kind of attorney.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different questions about the episode and some of the legal terms we talked about. So my first question is going to be, what are the four different types of ADR we discussed?
Arbitration and mediation.
Yeah, those are the two easies.
Negotiation.
Number three.
And collaboration.
Yeah, that's it. Collaborative law.
There you go. I should have thought of an acronym for those.
Well, there's too many consonants. There's not enough vowels.
No vowels. Okay. Alex, can I buy a vowel? Or whatever it is. Pat, whatever. Whoever it is that does that one. Pat does, I guess.
This is not a question, but of those four, what's your favorite?
I guess arbitration, because that's the one I described.
That's the one you like?
Yeah.
What is mediation? Well, how would you define it in one sentence?
Mediation is what you do before you go in for a lawsuit to try and see if there's any way you can resolve it without going to court.
Kind of. let's say mediation is a participant-driven process wherein a mediator, who is a neutral third party, tries to facilitate an agreement that parties agree to. How's that for a sentence?
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Well, you're better with words because you have to use them.
I talk good.
Yeah.
So mediation, yeah, is basically the process where there's a mediator who's neutral and does not make any kind of binding decision about the case. They're just there to kind of move the parties along and see if they can get an agreement so it can actually not go to court. And mediation can happen before a lawsuit is filed, or it could happen after a lawsuit's filed, but before a trial. So
the mediator's kind of like a laxative. He's there to just move the process along.
Yeah. Fair enough.
And if you reach an impasse, then you need an enema.
And what would that enema be called?
A silver bullet.
That's right.
What is a Coors Light?
What is the silver bullet?
A Coors Light. Bullet is the one thing that will fix it and is the answer to all the problems.
What is the process of a silver bullet in mediation, though? You remember?
Well, that's the mediator saying, this is what we're going to do. And everybody says, that's a great idea. Why didn't we think of that?
No. The mediator goes to one party and asks for their bottom line and says, I'm not going to disclose it to the other party.
And then they overlap. They meet or overlap. So then he says, you're not that far apart. I'm not going to tell you. But if you talk a little bit, I think we're going to make it.
That's right. If they overlap, then the case is resolved. If they don't, then the mediator might use that as a technique to keep people kind of moving on it. And there was one other kind of process at mediation, and it was called bracketing. What was bracketing?
Bracketing is when you try to get the other party, you try to get both parties to make a large jump in what they're doing, one to come down and one to go up, to try to meet somewhere in the middle, because they're just moving little increments, and you're not ever going to get there. So you try to get them each to agree to some large jump.
Right. So basically, you might say, I'll come down to this amount to $50,000 if you come up to $10,000. And the party either agree to it or they won't. So,
and if they don't, then you're done.
No, they can keep on going. It just can say, well, we don't want to do bracketing right now. We'll just keep doing these little piddly jump alongs. So, And what is the arbitration process?
The arbitration process is when both parties meet with an arbitrator. But they sign a binding agreement that says that they'll present their case, and at the end, they'll accept whatever the arbitrator decides.
That's right, if it's a binding arbitration. And there might be one or three arbitrators, but never two.
Never two or four.
Never two or four. It's just bad. Bad idea. And the arbitrator will make a decision about how the case is resolved. So.
And you have to accept it, even if you don't like it.
That's right.
You can appeal it, but unless they ruled on something outside the scope of the arbitration, then you're probably going to lose.
And who is your favorite TV judge?
Judge Judy.
That's right.
she's the girl.
So that's alternative dispute resolution. Do you know more about it now than you think you ever thought you did?
Absolutely. To me, arbitration and mediation were the same thing. Now I know there's a difference.
There are.
That's pretty good. And I've thought about it. I've decided if I was ever one of those mediators, my talk at the beginning, I'd say, all right, y'all, this is the way it's going to be. This here is going to be like... a couple that's been married for a long time making love. It's going to be over in 2 minutes. It's going to be a little bit messy. Nobody's going to be satisfied, but at least we got it out of the way for another month.
I don't think I would hire you as a mediator. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thoughts. Today's random thought is last names. Last names are a funny thing. I wonder about where last names came from. I always heard the story that most last names came from a person's trade way, way back in time when we first started giving people last names, I guess. I mean, when they were cavemen, I guess they just said, hey, you. But eventually, we got first names and last names. And the last names, they say, came from your craft or your job. For instance, Smith, it's a very common name, came from blacksmith, the guy that made your horseshoes. Carpenter, that's pretty straightforward. The guy was a carpenter. Tailor, he made clothes. Those are all common names. You have your baker and cook, almost the same thing, but one bakes and one cooks. That was their last name. Painter. I bet you could guess what that guy did. Then there's the name Jones. That one threw me because that's such a common name. I thought, well, why Jones? Well, it ends up, when I did a little research, that means Jehovah has favored. And Jones was a popular surname among European Christians. So that's where that came from. Then I started thinking about Smurl. What's a Smurl? Well, it turns out that also from Europe, there was certain fishermen, which Fisher, there's another last name for you with a craft, but there was a certain fish called a Smurl. It was spelled differently, but nonetheless, it was a Smurl. And apparently, that's where the name was derived from. Now, I started thinking of common names in places. Around here, a very common name is Adkins. Well, I mean, they didn't have the diet back then, so where did that come from? Well, it seems that Adkins was derived from a combination of the surname Adam and the word kin. So you were a kin of Adam, you were Adkins. So that's where that came from. That kind of made sense. Sweat was a common name in Waycross, in Georgia in general. When I was down there, I'd never heard the last name Sweat. Well, it ends up that ancient Anglo-Saxon name was given to a person who was referred to as sweet, S-W-E-T-E, which is an old English word used to describe a sweet or gentle person. There was actually a former congressman named Dick Sweat. So think of that what you will. Now, here's some names, though, some last names that I thought, where would those come from? Cock, daft, death, smelly, go to bed. I don't know if you pronounce it that way, but that's sure the way it's spelled. Shuffle bottom, dungworth, and butt or butts. Now, I don't know whether people were being mean to those people or something. It does say that cock denoted cockerel-like pride. So, okay, I think a cockerel's a dog, isn't it? So, dog-like pride. Daft, this meant meek and mild-natured in medieval times. Evidently, doesn't mean you're Looney Tunes like now. And death, was kind of a derivative of Diath, whatever that meant, capital D, little e, with a mark, and then a capital A-T-H. I don't know. I don't know where that came from. There's no explanation for smelly, although I guess I could think of one. Maybe the guy was a pig farmer or something. Shuffle bottom? The only thing it says is most bottoms came from a valley. Dungworth? He's worth dung. Go to bed. This guy evidently wanted to party all night. I don't know, but there are a few, though, that I've come across, and it makes me wonder what was going on. For instance, there was a robber that was being interviewed on a documentary, and the robber's name was Tokyo Sex Whale. Now, I know Tokyo, where that comes from. Of course, that's his first name, but the last name, Sex Whale? Then there was the unfortunate second grade teacher that I saw pictured in a yearbook with her second grade class, and her name was Mrs. Rape. I don't want to go back in time and find out why they're named that. Then there was a Dr. Farts, F-A-A-R-T-Z, Farts, and his first name was Wet, W-H-E-T. So he was actually Dr. Wet Farts. Then there was a congratulations in a local newspaper to a prize orchid grower. The guy's name was rather redundant, though, as he was Mr. Dick Cock. Stroker and his first name just happened to be Willie. If any of these guys killed their parents, it would probably be justifiable homicide. Now, the one, though, that got me thinking about this, that really got me started on this Tommy's Random Thought, was, I don't know if you've remembered some songs, Wondering Where the Lions Are, or If I Had a Rocket Launcher. There are two songs from the 80s by a guy that, well, I like his music. But his name is one that got me thinking about this. His name is Bruce Cockburn. I can only assume that Bruce has a poor ancestor somewhere back in history that had a really painful accident around a campfire. All I can think to say about that is, ouch. This has been Tommy's Random Thoughts.